Our topic for this evening is the Orthodox backlash, or basically the beginnings of Orthodox Judaism. In the first session, a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that traditional Judaism of the pre-modern period is not the same thing as Orthodox Judaism, but rather that Orthodoxy is a conscious reaction to something that is non-traditional, or perceived as being an attack on the traditional. So in our context, we discussed the Seisen Temple of Israel Jacobson of 1810, and then the services in Berlin in 1815, 1817, which were departures from the traditional synagogue style, whether in architecture, the nature of the liturgy, the character of the clergy. And then things moved on to Hamburg in 1818. And there was literature written to support the innovations that were done in the Hamburg Temple and the Berlin Temple, written by Eliezer Lieberman, Noga HaTzedek and Or Noga. And the rabbis of the traditional variety, of course, were not particularly happy with that literature. And then the Hamburg Temple crisis emerged. There was no chief rabbi in Hamburg because Raphael Cohen had resigned in 1799 after losing his police power, the power of the cherem, the power to coerce private individuals to observe the halakha. So the Beit Din did the best they could for the next 20 years. But with the emergence of a non-orthodox style of public worship, they felt they had to act. What is at their disposal? Well, they can't have any direct coercion. They could try to petition the government, the Hamburg Senate, to ban this newfangled synagogue. And they did that, but it failed. Efforts at using the government to intervene in internal Jewish affairs, at least in this instance, didn't work. So, what other options do they have? Public, moral suasion. Turning to the general Jewish public and saying, this is wrong. You should not be a part of it. Well, how do you get most Jews to be convinced that something is religiously inappropriate? You get the heavyweights of Judaism to issue condemning letters, epistles, missives sent from all over Europe that this is bad, this is horrible, this is a breach of tradition. So the Hamburg Beit Din sends out letters to all the major rabbis in Central Europe, and they ask for an opinion based upon three premises. One, Asur l'shanot Seder HaTefillah HaNehuga BeYisrael. What does that mean? It is forbidden to change the order of the prayers that it is customary in Israel. Min Birkot HaShachar Aracha Aleinu L'Shabeach. Okay, from page 18, Birkot HaShachar, all the way to page 158, Aleinu. Mikol Shekein She'en Ligroa Mimena. And all the more so, you can't detract or condense the service, because that's what the reformers would do. They would take a very lengthy service that is more than people can stomach and make it sort of like a church length kind of service, 45 minutes, an hour.
Yeah. Who are they addressing? Because if I'm a reformist, why do I care?
You don't. The whole point is to get the Gedolei Hador, the greats of the generation, to say unpleasant things about the reformers so that the average Jew on the street, who doesn't have a strong opinion either way, might be influenced to think, oh, well, maybe if the giants of Judaism think this is horrible, I should stay away. So the first issue was the length of the liturgy and tinkering with the liturgy.
Do the giants know these giants? I mean, the street, you know, how they know the difference between one to the other?
So some were great names who had achieved renown. Others were only locally famous, which means that if their name appears in a book, the guy in Hamburg doesn't know who that is. But others were legitimately very, very famous, like the Chatam Sofer. Okay. The second point is, Asur lehitpalel seder hatfilah halaz belashon acher chutz milashon hakodesh. You're not allowed to pray these prayers in any language other than Hebrew. V'chol tfilah hanidpeset shelo ketikuna, and any prayer book which is printed in an inappropriate fashion with the altered service, v'shelo kemenhagenu, not according to our custom, hi pesula, it is invalid. V'yasuli palimenon, you can't use it. So there's a treif prayer book. Let's condemn the prayer book, which is going to be an ongoing theme in the battle between orthodoxy and heterodoxy all the way till modern times, with the most famous episode being 1945 and the burning of Mordechai Kaplan's prayer book. All right, point number three. Asur l'nagein b'vet ha-knesset. You're not allowed to have musical instruments in the shul. B'shum klei yeshiva Shabbat v'yom tov, on Sabbath and holiday. Afilu al yedei goy. Even if played by a Gentile. So to go so far as to have a Jew play the instrument, maybe that even the early reformers weren't ready to do. But to have a Gentile, that they were ready to do. But the Orthodox backlash says that's no good, even if a Gentile plays the instrument. Okay. Well, the Hamburg Beit Din writes about a 5-page introduction in this book called Ele Divrei Habrit. Ele Divrei Habrit. These are the words of the covenant. And the 3 points are on the title page. And the title page basically says that this is our position. We're not going to write a long book defending it. We're going to ask the leading halachists of the generation to give their opinion, which we know will be in agreement with our own. And then we're going to publish it. And 22 out of a bunch more opinions were published in the volume as it came out in 1819, published in Hamburg Altona. So, what are some of the responses? Well, actually, before we get to the response, there's a little bit of a preamble in which the Dayanim try to show that they don't have any ill will towards anyone. That the Orthodox backlash is not out of animus towards any one Jew or any one group of Jews. It's not because we are hateful or spiteful, but rather for the honor of God and the Torah. So, vizot ladat, and you should all know the following. Ki amichtavim halalu, the following letters, did pasu lichvod HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'Torah Torah, for the honor of God and the Torah. V'lo chas v'shalom lekanter, o lachis shum yishmi Yisrael. Our intention is not to aggravate anyone, not to anger anyone. We're not looking to pick a fight. Now, of course, they are picking a fight, but their argument would be that the reformers who built the temple in 1817 are the ones who themselves initiated the conflict, and so that the Orthodox, the traditionalists, are not to be blamed for defending tradition, that they are not picking the fight, they're simply standing firm on behalf of God's Torah. All right? Yeah. Now, God, gam l'chavod kilat Yisrael, for the honor of the congregation of Jacob, lo'odia kim'at hema shenechshelu b'taut uvishkiyot katachadasha. There are very few people who have been ensnared in the error of this new sect, this katachadasha. Now, the use of the term kat is very important, because kat means an illegitimate sectarian group. You don't use the term kat to refer to a legitimate group within Judaism. When the tradition says that the temple was destroyed because Na'asu Yisrael kitot kitot, Israel was turned into sectarian groups, divided, so that's a very, very bad way for us to be. We're supposed to have an ichud, a united community, not a divided community.
Why would the word for kat be on a legitimate level?
No, it just means...
You wouldn't have a kosher group, let's say.
No, you wouldn't, no. Velo he, a kosher group would be a chevra. The chevra. Kvutza is more like modern Hebrew, but a chevra would be a traditional Hebrew word, rabbinic Hebrew word that connotes something virtuous. Yeah.
You mentioned that they were against praying in any other language besides. What about Yiddish?
So public prayer was not in Yiddish. We're talking about synagogue prayer, not about the private petitions of the individual. We're going to focus exclusively on the synagogue service. Okay.
In private.
In private. Okay. Now. Okay. So, in Germany, those Jews who did not have a strong Hebraic education, by the 18 teens, were likely to speak a fluent German. They were not likely to still be speaking Yiddish Deutsch or Western Yiddish dialect. That would have been true 30, 40 years earlier, but not by 1820. So there only is going to be an option of the traditional Hebrew liturgy or the vernacular German. Yeah?
When you always have these controversies, and then they express that it's only a small amount of people, when you come out publicly, you give them more publicity.
Ah, okay. So the notion that polemics is a bad idea because it raises the profile and prestige of the wrong side is something that the Chatam Sofer will worry about. And he'll be hesitant to engage in polemics. Ultimately, his letter will appear in this book, and in fact, two letters of his will appear, but he was hesitant because he said the other side will lie through their teeth. They'll say whatever they want. So it's not such a good idea to try to counter every point by point. They'll twist things to fit their advantage, and it'll elevate them in the eyes of the community that they have a retort. Whereas if you just leave them alone, maybe they'll disappear. That was a theory. In the end, they don't act on that theory, but rather engage in polemics. Okay, so back to the preamble. Velohigiu le'achad mimeya. What percentage of the community is now a part of this sectarian group? Echad mimeya, 1 in 100. Is that true?
No,
it's really more about 1 in 10. About 10% of the Hamburg community had an affinity for the temple. Not necessarily they were dues-paying members, but they were part of that group, we might say. And that percentage would increase over time, but not by so much. Whereas in other communities, the reform came to dominate the official kehillah by the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. In Hamburg, the official community remained Orthodox for a fairly long time, and the temple was the unofficial synagogue for those who wanted an alternative.
What advantage for using a lower percentage?
Well, the Dayanim don't want to give the impression that this is a reputable group with great numbers and strength, but rather it's a marginal phenomenon that we're trying to nip in the bud before it gets off the ground. Aval kol ha'ida kedoshim. Kol ha'ida kedoshim. Who said that? Korach. So why are they using that expression here? I don't know. But all right, kol ha'ida kedoshim. Everybody's holy. V'ruban reim u'shlemim. And most people are God-fearing and whole with God. Machazikim b'Torah Hashem, b'Torah shebichtav u'shebal peh, the written Torah and the oral Torah, meaning we are not Karaites, we're not Mosaists, we believe in Rabbinic Judaism. Kasher hayut, v'rak miyutei demiyutei hanashlim ayde zeh, ayde ezem mesitim medichim, a small percentage of the public has been ensnared by those who are the subverters. The mesitim mediach, in biblical terms, are those who try to get you to worship idols. So we're using really rough language in reference to the reformers. Gam zarim ba'u v'yishchitu et nachal ajit Hashem. Strangers came and corrupted or perverted the heritage of God. Who are the zarim? The zarim are the preachers who are not local Hamburg Jews, but rather they come from other places, possibly Berlin, as was the case with Edward Clay, who was hired from the Berlin Temple to go to the Hamburg Temple. So these outside agitators who are turning us into Reform Jews. Hashem tov yechaper ba'adam, v'yasim shalom ba'adenu, l'avdo shechem echad. So God should help us to restore peace in the community, that we should worship Him in one way. Okay, so that is the preamble. Now we go to some of the important details. The Dayanim recognized that for the longest time there had been a decline in general religiosity. When they say in the first page, oh, only 1 in 100 is tempted by reform, and that most people are shlemim and yirat Hashem are full in their fear of the Lord, that was hyperbole. Big-time hyperbole. What they really are willing to acknowledge is that for the past half century, there's been a downward spiral in religious observance, and there's nothing that we can do to stop it. Nothing we can do to stop it. But up until this point, there was never an attempt by those who had left traditional observance to establish a new style of Judaism recognized as legitimate Judaism, and with a house of worship that prays in accordance with its wishes, but rather those who were moving away from tradition just moved away from tradition. And so, while we're saddened by that, couldn't do much about it. When a competitor form of Judaism emerges, that needs to be suppressed. So that's the justification of the Dayanim for acting in 1819 as opposed to 1809 or 1799. That earlier it was just private decline in religiosity, whereas now it is objectionable forms of pseudo-Judaism. Yeah.
Is this only Germany at the time?
This is only in certain cities. By the late 18-teens, we're dealing only with certain communities in Westphalia, Berlin, Hamburg, and Amsterdam. And in France, you have a little bit of it, but not much. Okay. So, the argument is that Gentile rulers have long known about the return to Zion, and it never bothered them. One of the main points of the Reformers was that the concept of Shivat Zion, the return to Zion, is incompatible with what?
Emancipation.
With emancipation. If you're going to be a free citizen and no longer a ghetto Jew, you have to want to live here long term, and your religious scruples had best not conflict with true patriotism. So, therefore, in the Hamburg Temple, there were inconsistent attempts to rid the liturgy of any reference to return to Zion. When I say inconsistent, it's because, although doctrinally they would have wanted to do that 100% of the time, there are certain prayers that, the melody is beloved to us, or it's just the average Jew has a certain affinity for a certain tefillah, and you can't mangle the liturgy every time to fit your new doctrine. Some things, if the chazan sings v'sechazena einenu and it sounds good, you're going to take it away? Come on. So they don't take... Yeah.
Did they change this one Ezra to
Yerushalayim? Yes. Yes. Okay. So the argument of the traditionalist is that the Kaiser, the Emperor, the King has known about the doctrines of traditional Judaism from time immemorial. And it never troubled them that traditional Jews prayed for a return to Zion. Therefore, even in a period of emancipation, there is no need to change that because it's a messianic, it's a pious hope that doesn't conflict with realpolitik. Meaning it's not as though we're supporting the Habsburg Empire versus the Prussians or the Romanovs. Rather, we have this futuristic belief in a return to Zion that has no bearing on modern politics. So, why do you need to change it? Changing it is just a betrayal of Jewish values. Okay. Now, what are some of the changes that the Dayanim objected to? Number one, women singing in the shul. Number two, no Haftorah. They abolished the Haftorah. No Dalet Parshiot. So, Zachor, Para, Chodesh, Shkalim. Okay. No silent Amidah, which we learned about last week. No Megillah scroll. So they read the book of Esther.
From a book,
not from a scroll. Which is interesting because later they'd abolish Purim altogether since Purim is too Jewish and not Israelitish enough. Purim is the most Jewish holiday in the calendar, and it's the least biblical in the sense that what is the Bible? What is the Mosaic law? Peace, love, universalism. Whereas what is Purim? Purim is kill the goyim. So therefore, eventually Reform would abolish Purim for about 100 years, from the 1830s till the 1930s, and only bring it back in the days of Hitler, when Hitler is the new Haman. But in the beginning, they kept Purim, but they abolished the scroll. Why? Because the scroll is too Oriental. It's too Middle Eastern. We read books. We don't have parchment that looks like it's from the Stone Age.
So
abolish the Torah.
Right.
Inconsistencies, I tell you. That to abolish the Torah would have been a step too far. And only one rabbi was willing to go that far, Mendel Hess, and the rabbi in Weimar, who was the most vicious anti-Semitic rabbi in the history of the world. He wanted to abolish all traditional things, but Hamburg was not ready for that yet. And most of Reform Judaism in 19th century Germany was not ready for that kind of a step. I don't know. I have to look that up. Next week we'll discuss him a little bit more.
People have to understand, all of these guys had Orthodox.
Correct. Every single one. Right. Okay.
Wait, so why would they want to abolish the Haftorah? That's the universal prophetic writing.
So the answer is that the Haftorah probably was not abolished. When the Dayanim and the Elidei Habrit are discussing activities of the Hamburg Temple, they may be mischaracterizing it a little bit. Most likely there was Haftorah, but in German. There was a common thing in 19th century Reform, and maybe even in 20th century American Reform, that the Haftorah is read in the vernacular. That the Torah was read in the original Hebrew out of the scroll, not necessarily the whole Parsha, but some of the Parsha was read in the original Hebrew, but the Haftorah was read in the vernacular. Okay. What else? So, there's a... Let's now return to the Chatam Sofer. So, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, there's the chief rabbi of Pressburg, of Bratislava, which is today the capital of Slovakia, but then in those years was regarded as a Hungarian city, in which the Jews spoke either Yiddish or German, not Magyar, and not the Slovak language. And it was a fairly traditional city, Jewishly speaking. The Chatam Sofer, who was born in 1762, dies in 1839, is the chief rabbi in Pressburg from about 1806 to his death, is the leader of the Old Guard Orthodoxy. And turning to him meant turning to the Gadol Hador. So what does he say? He does not look at each and every one of the reforms done by the Hamburg Temple and try to nitpick how they're anti-halachic. Why not? Because he understands that the book that's being produced, the Ilah Divrei HaBrit, if it's going to be impactful at all, it has to speak to the masses. The masses cannot understand Talmudic dialectics and minutiae of the hyper-commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch. It has to address matters that the Amcha can appreciate. So, what can the Amcha appreciate? Tradition, in its general sense. People like tradition, and they don't like an assault on tradition. So that's what he will emphasize. First point is, the shul was closed all week. It's only open on Saturday. Now, to an American Jew, they'll say, okay, all right, the shul's open on Saturday. But to a Jew in Central Europe in the 18-teens, especially at least a nominally traditional Jew, communal prayer is a daily experience. And not just daily, but thrice daily. And the average Jew respected the importance of tefillah b'tzibur in the continuity and the sustaining of Judaism. So to say, oh, this place is open for business one day in seven, but closed the other 6 days, that's a real shtuch, it's a real attack on them, that the average person could read and accept. Yeah, what kind of religion is this one day a week? The vernacular, getting rid of Hebrew, getting rid of the return to Zion, music, a revised liturgy. So, he also says that they are making things up. Badu otami libam. They are fabricating Judaism. What is religion? Religion is the received religion, that which we get from our forebears. If it's brand new, does it have validity? Now, some people like things that are new, but in the realm of religion, old is good and new is bogus. That's his basic argument. Okay, it's an appeal to the virtue of antiquity. And he says, they are overturning 2,000 years of tradition. 2,000 years of tradition. I actually find this very fascinating because, remember, this is being written in 1819. In what famous song do we use the word 2,000? Hatikva! Shnot Alpayim! Now, when Hatikva was written, was it 2,000 years since the Churban, since the destruction of the Temple? No, it was about 1,800 and something. All right, 1948 is not 2,000 years after the year 70. But to round it off, to make it sound even more impressive, 2,000. So already in 1819, he's breaking out the 2,000 number. I think he's the first one to do so. I can't say it with certainty. I haven't read every Jewish writing from that era. But to my knowledge, this is the first reference to Shnot Alpayim. Okay. Then he says, certain reforms of the liturgy and of synagogue practice might theoretically be possible if they don't overturn biblical law, but rather overturn a custom or a rabbinic enactment. But what do you need, in a technical sense, to overturn an earlier rabbinic enactment?
Sufficient
A later rabbinic enactment.
Correct, but a later rabbinic enactment done by whom? A greater Beit Din. Yeah, they have to be greater b'chokhmah uv'minyan. In chokhmah and wisdom, and in minyan, the number of people who support this proposal. Now, arguably,
which means it can't be.
It can't be that it can never happen. This is a technicality that exists for the purpose of being conservative, lowercase c. That you could never overturn an old law because there's yiridat hadorot. There's the decline of the generations. Whether it's true or not, objectively, we perceive a decline of the generations. That the sages of old were the great ones, and we are inferior by comparison. So therefore, even rabbinic decrees can't easily or at all be overturned. All right? Now, then he says, the reformers are not gedolei Torah. Whenever you have a dispute between rabbis, what's the trump card? I'm a bigger rabbi than you are. I know more than you. And who's to say? Who's the judge? There is no judge. It's just an assertion. But when you make an assertion, you can get away with it if your reputation is a fairly august reputation. And you can't get away with it if you're seen as basically a nobody. So the Chatam Sofer is able to say that the preachers in the Hamburg temple, who are not even ordained rabbis, who are not Talmudic scholars, are just guys who can give a good German sermon, that they're nothing compared to him. And therefore, who is the Jewish public going to listen to? The great rabbis of Hungary or some young whippersnapper in northern Germany? Well, that's exactly the point. So since this is geared towards the laity that is still traditional and that still respects rabbinic authority, they're going to listen to this. Okay. Okay, so the answer to that is depends where. In his own country, in the Habsburg realm, his authority was great. In the Germanic lands, not nearly as much. And especially in northern Germany, which is quite a distance away, yes, he was known as a great rabbi, but he's not the local authority figure. Okay. Then he has a very important point. And I haven't seen any other great rabbinic figure in the 19th century make this point. He says, life is pleasant in the galut, in our lands. Now, everybody always says that, even when it's not pleasant, because you don't want to offend the king. Even in the Tsarist Empire, there was, our wonderful Tsar, he treats us so nicely. But he says, even if life were pleasant in the galut, that is not enough. We must pray for Zion. The argument of the Western European maskilim and reformers was that what we want is to be treated nicely and to live like a mensch, like a human being. And that in the pre-emancipation era, it was believed that we could only have that with the return to Zion and our own national sovereignty. But with the arrival of the modern nation state and with the giving of civil rights to the Jews, we no longer need a return to national sovereignty. In fact, we don't want it anymore because we have the good life here and now. That Berlin is the New Jerusalem or Hamburg is the New Jerusalem. And Chatam Sofer's point is not to reject the tranquility of the Western diaspora. He's acknowledging, yeah, it might be very comfortable. It might be you're living a materially good existence with newfound privileges and freedoms. But that isn't enough. You need to have Zion. That as a good Jew, you want more than just material comfort and political rights. You want national restoration. Okay. So for American Zionists and for Western Zionists who live in countries where we do have freedom, this is a very important point to consider. Okay.
Where does it come with Kibbutz Zion?
Well, he dies long before that happens. Kibbutz Zion first gets off the ground in 1882. No, there are others in the mid 1800s who are a more direct link to Chibat Zion that we probably won't discuss in this course because we're going to try to stay away from Zionism as a purely political matter. Although we may get to it eventually. Understood. We're going to get to the role that Zionism plays in drawing divisions within Orthodoxy when we get to chronologically that point. So. Then he says something else. God will reward our kindly Gentile rulers so that they should not have a problem with the restoration of Zion. Meaning, the Kaiser, the King, the Emperor, whatever it is, might have a problem. If the Messiah came tomorrow and a significant portion of his population was Jewish and a significant part of his economy was conducted by Jews and all of a sudden they picked up and left, would that be good for business? No, the GDP would go down. So he says, don't worry, the Ribono Shel Olam, God will protect the economies of these countries and the rulers of these countries, that Lo Yitzer, just in case Messiah comes tomorrow, it will not have a deleterious effect on Hungary or Austria or Germany. Don't worry, God will protect our kindly Gentile rulers.
That's a safe statement.
It's a very safe statement. But why is he making this statement? Because he's trying to show that there is no real-world consequence, negative real-world consequence, to the various European nation states, to the Jewish theological belief in the return to Zion, that it's a completely power of idea from a political point of view. Don't worry about it. It's our religious thing, and it doesn't affect you in any way, certainly not in a negative way. If anything, it'll be in a positive way. Okay. Then he says like this.
American Jewry go through the same thing in the 1930s between the American Jewish Congress and the American Jewish Committee.
Well, the American Jewish Committee will long be anti-Zionist.
Yeah, with the same rationale.
Well, the rationale of the American Jewish Committee types was that it's a problem of dual loyalty.
Yeah.
And, of course, the trouble is that the only people who really made that argument were not viciously anti-Semitic Gentiles. They were Jews, like weak-kneed Jews.
Yeah, who Jews.
Well, not all of them were Reform. Some of them were non-denominational in the sense that there was no religion altogether. But these are weak-kneed Jews who raise a point that our adversaries were not raising. Okay. Next point. The reformers who don't believe in the restoration are heretics. Heretics. That's a strong statement. They are minim. Heretics. There is a great debate and a wide diversity of opinion about what is the nature of the restoration. Now, the most fundamentalist point of view is that there's going to be a personal Messiah who is a great-great-great-great-grandson of King David who will come on a donkey down Mount Olives, and all of a sudden the temple will be coming down from heaven in a fiery blaze. That's the most fundamental point of view about messianic times. But even if you don't accept the most fundamentalist point of view, even if you just believed in the 1800s, in an eventual restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, or the Kibbutz Galuyot, the return of Jews from the four corners of the earth to the Holy Land, that was something. You believed in a return. To have none of that, to say none of that will ever happen, is in the eyes of the Chatam Sofer treasonous. And it makes you a heretic. Not only does it make you a traitor from the secular national point of view, but it makes you religiously a heretic. Okay. Then he turns to the music in the shul. No music in the shul, especially not on Shabbos. Does he try to prove it from halachic sources? Not really. He just makes a categorical statement. You can't have it. And as for vernacular prayer, it's only for individuals, and only occasionally, but not for the congregation. And he has an interesting proof. Let me hear what you think of this proof. When the Torah was read in antiquity, after the verse was read in Hebrew, what happened next?
You had a Meturgaman.
You had an Aramaic translator who read the Unculus or whatever other Aramaic translation was used. When the Chazan gives the repetition of the Shemona Esrei, what happens next?
We talk,
and the guy says Kaddish. Is there an English or a German or a Yiddish translation of the Shemona Esrei? No! Which the Chatam Sofer says is a proof that comprehension in prayer is not the be-all and end-all. You don't need to understand the prayer. You need to recite the prayer as composed by the great sages of yesteryear, and it should hopefully have some emotional impact upon you, but comprehension is not everything. If it were, there would have been a Meturgaman, and there wasn't. So, you don't need vernacular public prayer. It's a decent proof. Okay. Next point.
I don't know
about that. You don't know? Okay, all right. I'm willing to accept some feedback.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What kinds of annotations and help people understand?
That was pre-art scroll.
Okay, but even in the art scroll age, even with the interlinear prayer book, ultimately what they want you to say is the Hebrew liturgy. You have, you know, the slashes and the thing below the English, the two words and the next phrase and next phrase to give you some guidance as to what you're mumbling, but they want you to mumble the Hebrew. Okay? So he's not so off base. Then he has another point. When you go to speak to the king, you speak in the official language of the kingdom. Bear in mind that he's in Hungary, and the Habsburg Empire was a multinational polyglot empire with 11 major national groups and a whole lot of languages. But what was the official language?
German.
When you went to Vienna, what did you speak? You spoke German. So he says, even if the king understands your ethnic dialect, you would never have the chutzpah to speak in that ethnic dialect in the king's palace in Vienna. What were you going to speak? In German. So when you go to the Melech Malchei HaMlachim, the King of Kings, the Almighty, what's the Almighty's language? What's the language of creation? Hebrew. So even though God understands your German or your Yiddish or your Hungarian, and you would understand it better too if it was in the vernacular, when you go to God's palace, what do? You speak in the Hebrew. All right. That's a nice proof. I like that. It depends where. In Yemen, it hung around for a long time, even until almost modern times. In Ashkenazic lands, it disappeared, I think, basically with the founding of Ashkenazic communities.
Why?
Because they weren't speaking Aramaic as a vernacular. They spoke Laz, which was like Old French. So you're not going to have two languages you don't know. It's bad enough the Hebrew you don't know.
Yeah.
To have also Eastern Aramaic that nobody knows for 1,000 miles? Is that it? Okay. Some of the expressions that he writes, I'd like to quote from the original Hebrew. He says, "Al tishanu mimin hagavotechem." Don't change from the custom of your fathers. That's borrowed from a Talmudism of Min Hagavotenu Biadenu. It's an appeal to generational continuity. Why should you not change what you're doing? Because your father did it. Your grandfather did it. Zaidi did it. There's an emotional impact when you say something is not just custom, but minag avotenu, our forefathers.
I think that there's a fallacy there, because the reformists did not have that mindset.
Correct.
So if they didn't have the mindset, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, these are your forefathers. They said, what are you talking about?
So there are those who will reject this outright, but among those to whom an appeal to tradition is still meaningful, these kinds of slogans can work wonders.
So he's preaching to the converted.
He's preaching to those who have yet to be unconverted.
Yeah, he's preaching to the choir.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, then he says like this.
But didn't they have
Yes, yes.
Young Israel
custom.
Each city had their own.
Okay, right. So the argument of the reformers in a book that would be lampooning this Eli Divrei HaBrit, which came out a year later, was known as Cherev Nokemet Nekam Brit, the sword that avenges. And in that book, it basically puts to shame a lot of the Orthodox arguments by saying there's no unified ritual that is applicable in all Ashkenazic lands. There's a custom in this city, in that city, in this city, in that city. There's diversity of practice, so we'll make a little more diversity. It's not as though we are creating a breakaway faction from a united block of Ashkenazic Jewry. It's simply not the case. So you're right. That would be a very strong reformist argument.
But nobody had music. I mean,
in Prague, there was music, but not on Shabbos. But not on Shabbos.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I think the only major Orthodox synagogue
it's
had
true.
An organ playing up until Ms. Mashiach.
It's true. Yeah.
Is this only limited to a temple or prayer? What about the concept of divorce? What about the concept of marriage? Was that also
okay? So, issues of personal status are very important, but those are the sorts of things that are going to require rabbinical involvement, and so the reform movement will not address those matters until there are reform rabbis. At this stage in the game, there are only reform preachers in a handful of temples in a few of the acculturated cities. But by the 1840s, which we'll discuss either next week or the week after, when you have the reform rabbinical conferences of 1844, 45, and 46, that's when issues of marriage and divorce will be front and center, in addition to matters of liturgy and synagogue practice. And so you're going to get very non-traditional answers at that point, like abolishing the need for a get, or basically having civil marriage be recognized as Jewish marriage. Those will definitely happen. Yeah.
The concept, when was that written?
1819.
So before the only
20
before
years.
Before Rabbinic came about, uh-huh. Who performed the marriages for these Reformed Jews?
And that's a good question.
And was it recognized?
So that's a very good question. I believe that in Hamburg, the preachers could officiate at these ceremonies, but then it would have to go to the town clerk. So there would be a difference between the registered marriage and the religious ceremony.
So was it recognized like our problems of today?
No, because at least in certain parts of Germany, it was totally separate. The rabbi was not an officiant of the state.
Do you even need a rabbi for a wedding?
No, you don't. You just need someone to give a speech under the chuppah. Okay, I just want to do a few more lines.
Right.
Then the Chatam Sofer says, Ein ba tam v'reach Torah. That has no taste or smell or flavor of Torah. That the Chatam Sofer is saying here that when you read a Hebrew work, when you read a Torah work, you can tell that it's within the bounds of tradition by the flavor of the work. Whereas this, when you read the works of Noga Tzedek and Or Noga, or you hear about the practices in the temple, it doesn't sound Jewish. It's very un-Jewish, contrary to the Torah. Then he says, Aval halbish ha-Torah malbushei nechar b'tzibur lo tikein Ezra. That even if you could argue that vernacular prayer has its place in Jewish life, it has a limited place in Jewish life. That Ezra, meaning the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, the greats of the early Second Temple period who established public prayer, they did not take foreign garb and wrap the Torah in it. Lo hilbish ha-Torah mabushei nechar. It means that the temple is like a church. The early synagogues, the early public prayer fora in Judaism, were not like foreign houses of worship. They had a flavor of Judaism, and this place doesn't. Even if you have a room for vernacular prayer, you should never, ever have the chazan getting up in front of the congregation and davening in a language that isn't the holy tongue. Okay, then he has a good zinger. Who allowed these people, these reformers, to forsake the guidance of the local rabbinate and adopt the viewpoint or accept the viewpoint of people who live thousands of miles away? Remember what I said last week. Who were the three rabbis who supported the temple innovations? Where did they live? One lived in the southeastern Hungary, in Arad, Aaron Koriner, and the other two were Italian. Was there a single German rabbi willing to support the temple? No! So the Krovim are the German rabbis who are all against it. The Rechokim, the foreign ones, the distant ones, are these Italian rabbis who no one ever heard of. Or some guy in the far reaches of Hungary that no one ever heard of. So who allowed them to accept these random opinions from the middle of nowhere? Aaron Koriner. Aaron Koriner.
Yeah, he was the home base.
No, he was not.
He was Hungarian, wasn't he?
But this is in northern Germany, and he's in southeastern Hungary.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So basically what he's saying is, even if you don't understand the
tefillot, yeah,
the intent is more important.
Yes, absolutely. He's saying that. Yeah. Okay. Now, then he asks a question, a rhetorical question. What caused the exile of the Jews from Spain and many other tsarot that befell our people? So he says, what caused the exile from Spain was Sham Hakol Karvul Haumot Urachakum Echachmei Yisrael. They acculturated. They became too much like the surrounding peoples, and they distanced themselves from the sages of Israel. So what is he intimating might happen? The demise of German Jewry because of rampant acculturation and a rejection of traditional Judaism. So he's in it writing in 1819, but 120 years later he's not far off. Okay. I'm not saying the Holocaust. I'm saying the demise of German Jewry.
It's the same argument.
It's not the same argument, because the Holocaust happens after the demise of German Jewry. German Jewry is effectively dead by the late 30s. Yes, there are still a 250,000 Jews there, but as a vibrant community, it has ceased to be all that relevant. Half the people fled in the 30s because of the Nazi takeover. All the cultural institutions were shut down. The rabbinical seminaries were shut down in 1938, Kristallnacht. So acculturation can be punished in very severe ways. I'm not saying it, the Chatam Sofer is saying it. Now, we go to a few other letters that appeared in that book. So one of the writers says, Min Hagan Shel Yisrael Torahi. The custom of Israel is Torah. Which means what? It means that even if something is not a biblical law, or even a rabbinic law, even if something is just local custom, but has been hallowed by some measure of time, and encrusted in communal practice, it has the status of being like the Holy Torah itself. So therefore, the reformers, when they try to do away with so-called minor minhagim, what are they really doing away with? Torah. We're elevating the status of a custom to a much higher level, which is a theme in the Chatam Sofer's writings later on. But here is in one of the other authors, that minhagan shel Yisrael Torahi.
There's a saying, that it's harder to change a minute than it did. I don't know where it comes from.
Yeah. It's true. It's true.
Where does that come from? What's the
There's no textual proof for that. It's just sociologically true that something which is beloved by the community as a communal practice is not so easy to do away with, whereas dinim, we all have a yetzer hara to violate the din. There's an evil inclination to be antinomian, to subvert the law. But custom, it's our custom, you know. Now, in the counter argument, in the book written after this by the reformers, they said the opposite. If the Orthodox say Minhag Yisrael Torahi, the reformers would argue, no. Halavai, that the Torah should be Minhag Yisrael. Meaning, if only that the actual Bible was the custom of Jewish people, that we kept biblical laws, you know, ethical laws and the like. So don't tell me the Minhag is Torah, tell me the Torah is the Minhag. That's the counter-argument. Okay.
Yeah, but that counter-argument says, then why not follow the Torah?
That's too much detail. Okay. You're right.
I'm sorry.
Too much detail. So, then the Zimnin Tlatin B'Yom Atzali. How old of a practice is thrice daily prayer? It goes back to biblical times. In the book of Daniel, it says that he prayed three times. So how are you going to abolish that and have one prayer service a week? No good. Poresh minat zibur, these people are separating themselves from the community. Whereas the Torah says, Torah achat yelachem, there should be one Torah for the entire community. Not a Torah for the Orthodox, a Torah for the Reform. Shualim ketanim, these are small foxes, as opposed to big lions. In the Talmudic jargon, if you want to say that someone is a big shot religiously, he's one of the big lions. If he's a nothing, he's a small fox. Okay. Skip a little bit. Da-da-da-da. Okay. Another author said, "Pritzei hador badu milibam minhagim," that the licentious ones of the generation invented newfangled customs. Now, the pritzei hador, you could argue this has a sexual connotation, or maybe it doesn't. But either way, we're using very salty language to badmouth those who are innovating when it comes with regard to the synagogue. Is that nice? It's not very nice, but then again, the gloves are off. So all forms of verbal and written attack are now in play. Okay. The Beis Din of Prague had a very interesting comment. He said, these people, these reformers, be'emet, in truth, einam lo ivrim velo notzrim. Oive, they're nishtehin nishteher, they're not Jewish and they're not Christian. Now, that may be true. They're not so Jewish, and they're certainly not Christian because they're not believers in Jesus or the Trinity. But what's the political connotation of this argument? It's very important. In early 19th century Europe, is there an option of being an agnostic or an atheist, of being a non-confessional? No. You have to participate in some church, some organized, recognized church, with Judaism being one of them. for at least for native-born Jews. So to say someone is not a Jew by virtue of their heresies, but also not a Christian, is to say they're neither here nor there, they're illegal. Yeah?
Is he excommunicating them?
So that's a tricky issue, because excommunication was no longer allowed. Official cherem was taken away from the rabbis. So to say that they're in cherem would get you into legal trouble. But to call them heretics, it's just the same as well. Now, to say they're neither Jews nor Christians means that they're untrustworthy. Why does someone need a religion? Because if you don't have religion, your vow, your promise, your oath, your swear, it's not in the name of God, it's unacceptable. You could be a liar, a scoundrel. So you need religion. Society needs religion. And these people don't have this and they don't have that. They have nothing. And so therefore they're bad people. All right? That's the argument. Now, okay. One of the letter writers says, Oseh hadashot ba'al milchamot. Those who make new things are the ones who are waging war. So don't think that we, the traditionalists, who are writing these nasty letters condemning the behaviors of the temple, are the ones who are picking a fight, but rather the innovators are the ones who are guilty if there is a religious war within Jewry. Okay. Binyan ne'arim stira. The buildings built by the young people is really stira, destruction. And stirat zekenim, binyan. The destruction done by the elders is actually an act of building. This is an age-old Talmudic piece of wisdom, pearl of wisdom, that the young people don't know what they're doing. The elders, they have wisdom, they know from experience. So the elder rabbis are all against this new practice. But the young people who don't know any better, the young whippersnappers, they want to have a temple, but they're really destroying Judaism.
I said that about the
young Israel. Oh, yeah, okay, all right. Yeah.
And they were right.
They were at least right about Chazonis, yeah. So, Kol HaMishaneh Yado al hatachtona. I like this one. Kol hamishaneh yado al hatachtona. Anyone who changes something, his hand is the weaker hand. His hand is on the bottom. If you ask who has the upper hand or the lower hand, who is in a position of logical strength, argumentative strength, or weakness, those who are preserving the status quo have the strength, the establishment, and those who would like to do something new, they have to prove the merits of their innovation. And if they can't, then it shouldn't happen. Okay. Now, Rabbi Yaakov of Lisa, who was the author of the Chavos Das, one of the important Achronim, he made it very personal. He said, Ki im lemischar nichnas mechaber Or Noga. The author of Or Noga, The Radiant Light, Eliezer Lieberman, who wrote the book in favor of the Berlin Temple, he did it for money, meaning it was insincere. He's like a paid, hired goon by the reformers who needed a Talmudist to write some tract in their favor, but that really he's not a sincere reformer. All right? Ein b'chol tefilatenu shim nigud neged shlom ha-malchut, that there's nothing in our prayers that goes against the peace of the kingdom, which he, Lieberman, claimed was the case. No, we pray for the peace of the kingdom, and don't think otherwise. Then he says, Ochlim al shulchanot minivelot utrefot, v'doshim bagadot divrei dofi. Their preachers eat treif and give nonsensical sermons, which twist the Torah in a false manner.
Is that true? I mean, the eating treif.
So, a family member of mine, of blessed memory, once saw a woman rabbi buying meat in the supermarket, treif meat, and it turned her off to kashrus for a while. If the rabbi could do it, I could do it. She later changed her ways. But so we see that they were eating treif. Yes, not necessarily right away, but eventually the reformers. So I don't know. I don't know. When did the reformers begin eating non-kosher, at least the leadership of reform? So Abraham Geiger, the granddaddy of Reform Judaism, kept kosher his whole life. But why? because he was a communal rabbi, and as a communal rabbi, he felt that he owed it as a sort of a moral principle, not as a religious scruple, but as a moral principle, he owed it to his community to maintain the religious standards that the laity was still observing. So in other words, if kashrus has not been officially abrogated, how could I as the rabbi eat pork? But not that he thought that God really didn't want him to eat pork. But there were others who got rid of the whole enterprise of kashrus. Mordechai Kaplan, of course, kept kosher, yes, but he believed that there was social value, social utility in keeping kosher. And for Jewish continuity purposes, there were his benefits to keeping kosher. Okay.
Didn't the early reformers feel that they were staving off assimilation?
Yes.
And by making things a little easier, Jewish people would stay.
Yes, that was the argument of Israel Jacobson, that he was bringing people into the synagogue who had not been in a synagogue in decades because they were turned off by the old style religion, but found this palatable. Okay. Now,
what about the bris?
We're going to spend a whole week about bris after Sukkot.
8 days. We're going to spend 8 days.
We're going to spend a session.
See, that's
we're going to spend a session on bris and efforts to involve the government in coercing Jews who were reluctant to circumcise the children. Okay.
Because when you have a pogrom, you can tell who you're going to kill.
Well, the government was in favor of maintaining circumcision, but in the end did not use the police power to enforce it.
Yeah. When was Hirsch?
Hirsch, 1808 to 1888. We'll get to him soon enough. Okay. Now, the author of Or Noga, Holech Choshech Vein Nogalo, Flubabi Rav Lo Kara. So the argument is this Lieberman character, he's an Amaretz. He doesn't even know how to read the Bible. And that's not fair. He was Talmudically learned enough that he could write the book. But the Orthodox backlash says, he was an ignorant fool. Moreover, Eliezer Treitsch, who was one of the Gedolim, said that Lieberman had no ethical principles, and he wrote the book for money, and he was always in debt, and he needed cash, and that he gambled and played cards for money, and that's why he turned to the Hamburg Kehillah, because it was an opportunity to make a buck. So the first work of serious Judaic scholarship in favor of the Reformation of Judaism was arguably written because a guy had blackjack debts. Okay.
Yeah, but that adds more onto it. Somebody's pusillanimous if they're a.
That's so true. Misachik Bekuvia, so they're nullifying his ability to testify about anything or to write a halachic literature. Okay. Now, Eliezer Treitsch also said, why is it that of all the various communities, Hamburg was the one that has to be disgraced by having a temple in its midst? You know, it could have been any European city. Why Hamburg? What did they do wrong to deserve this shanda of a temple? So, before I tell you what it was, give me a guess.
The government didn't have any intervention with it.
Well, that's a legitimate political historical answer. Give me a religious answer that one of the rabbis might have suggested.
Mixed answer.
Wait, what do you say? Sinas chinam. Bingo. That's going to be one of them. What's the other one?
Mixed dancing.
That's 20th century. Oh. Give me another one. Aside from sinas chinam. What? Coming for the rabbi, maybe, but other than Sinas Chinam, what's the classic one we always blame?
The Goyim.
No, what Avera? No. Lashon Hara, bingo. Okay, so Lashon Hara, Sinas Chinam, and talking in Shul. Those are your top three. So that's why he says Hamburg was punished, that it should be the one to have the disgrace of the temple. Now, at the end of the book, Ilah Divrei HaBris, on the last page, there's a retraction. Aaron Horner, the Hungarian rabbi, who had issued one of the opinions in favor of the Berlin Temple, retracted his opinion that appeared in Noga HaTzedek, and says, I was wrong, Chatasi, I was wrong. And the authors of El Divrei HaBris, the Hamburg Dayanim, and Chassam Sofer, accepted that retraction and considered Aaron Horner back in their good graces. But it was really only temporary, because Aaron Horner had a long and checkered history of favoring progressive innovations in Judaism. This was not the only episode. He had other things before, and he had other things after. So although he was, for a moment, brought back into the fold of the traditional rabbinate, he'd be expelled again later. So his memory in the collective memory of Orthodoxy is still that of a disgraced individual. That Chorinah represents Chorin, free, he was emancipated from the Halakha, or the Kor Shul, the Choir Shul. He doesn't have a great legacy within the traditional community. Okay, we'll stop here, and next time...